We're in a new collection of teachings titled P.S. I Love You as we read through each of the letters to the seven churches in the book of Revelation. And last week we established that as we read through these letters, we're meant to make this connection that God is addressing more than just these seven churches through these letters. He's addressing all churches for all of time. So although we're reading specific letters to address to specific issues within specific local churches, we can be sure that he's saying what he's saying to each of these churches, he's also saying to us. And so I want us to imagine that each of these letters begins with the words, Dear 99. As he's addressing these seven churches, I want us to imagine that he's addressing 99, that he's addressing our community, our little band of rebels and runaways, and posture ourselves to listen, to learn, and to heed these words because they are for us. And so last week, we started with the letter to the church in Ephesus, and today we're reading through the letter to the church in Smyrna. Now, psychologist Jonathan Haidt once asked people to imagine a very real and difficult set of scenarios. He said, imagine that you were handed a script of your newborn child's entire life. And at the same time, you're also handed an eraser. And you're given 5 minutes to edit anything that you want out of that script. And so imagine yourself, you're looking at this script and everything looks great. Oh my God, she was a beautiful newborn, had an amazing infant stage. But then you read to the part where your child will have a learning disability in elementary school. Now, while reading will come easily for other kids, for your child, it's going to be very difficult. And then you read on that in high school, she's going to make a great group of friends, but they will later betray her and emotionally wound her. And then after high school, she gets into her favorite college. But while she's there, she gets into a car crash that significantly injures her. And following that, she falls into a deep depression. A few years later, you read on in the script that she gets a job and then loses that job in an economic downturn.
Eventually, she gets married and then has to experience the grief of separation. Now, reading the script of your child's life in your hand, the question that the psychologist asks us to ponder is this. What would you erase? If you had 5 minutes and you had an entire script of your child's life, what would you erase? And for most of us, the inclination we would have is to do everything we possibly could to eliminate all the pain and all the suffering that our child would experience. But then the psychologist asks us another question to ponder. He asks us, if your child never knew failure, and never knew disappointment, and never knew pain, never knew suffering, would that really be good for them? Would that cause them to grow into the best version of themselves? I think it's very easy for us to organize our lives around the avoidance of suffering. Especially here in the West, happiness is one of the greatest values that we treasure, and we do everything we possibly can to protect our happiness, to protect our comfort. But we're confronted with this cold, hard truth that's true for every single human being in existence, and it's this: we cannot avoid suffering. In fact, the more we try to avoid it, the more we seem to suffer. The great Thomas Merton, theologian, pastor, and mystic, he once said, the more you try to avoid suffering, the more you suffer, because smaller and more insignificant things begin to torture you in proportion to your fear of being hurt. The one who does the most to avoid suffering is, in the end, the one who suffers most. I hate running. You guys know this. I talk about running all the time. I have a love-hate relationship with running. And there's this thing, like, if I know that I'm going into a running session and I've made up in my mind I'm going to run a long distance today, when I approach that running session, even though I hate running, like, I can bear through it. But there's something that happens when I go into a running session and I haven't decided how long I'm going to run that day. And if in the beginning I'm running and in the middle of my running, I make a decision, I'm going to do a long run today, I can't do it for the life of me. There's something about knowing that suffering is ahead. There's something about knowing that hard work is ahead. There's something about knowing that pain is ahead that actually prepares us to deal with it well. And sometimes the understanding and acceptance that we will suffer eases the experience of suffering, if even just a little bit. It still sucks, but it makes it that much more bearable. And so the question we have to wrestle with isn't how do we avoid suffering at all costs? The question is, how do we remain faithful to Jesus in our suffering? And it's here where we turn to Jesus' words in his letter to the church in Smyrna. Revelation 2, 8 through 11. This is the word of the Lord. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, "These are the words of him who was the first and the last, who died and came to life again. I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death." I don't know if you've noticed, what's interesting about Jesus' letter to Smyrna is that it's one of two letters out of the seven that don't have any criticism. Jesus doesn't confront them about anything. There are no words of critique or correction. Jesus only has words of praise for them, words of encouragement to persevere. There was this one time where I was in Kansas City at this big church, and they were known to have like a charismatic prophetic culture. And so honestly, there were a lot of weirdos out there. I was with two other friends, and we were walking around, and I do believe in the gifts of the Spirit, especially the gift of prophecy. But there's this one lady that approached us, and we could tell she was kind of off. And she just walked up to us three guys, and she's like, "I feel like I have a word of the Lord for each of you." And so she starts praying for us. And first she starts with my friend, who I'll just say his name starts with a J. He prays for Jay, and he's praying for him. And she's like, "I just sense the Lord is disappointed in you." I was like, "Oh, the audacity." It's like, "God says that you are lazy and you're on your butt." And she's saying all these negative things to him and finishes the prayer. I was like, "That's not very encouraging." And then she looks to me. I'm like, "All right, I've been good. I started being a pastor. Like, come on." She starts praying for me. She says, "And you're even worse than him. You're doing nothing at home. You're not seeking the Lord." And I was in the middle of a fast during that time, but she's like, "You're not seeking the heart of God." She finishes prayer, all negative stuff. And then she looks to our third friend, and I'm like, "All right, she's going to rip into him." We're kind of laughing at this point because we're not receiving this seriously. But she looks at her third friend, and she's like, "Oh, and God's very pleased with you." And then she walks away. And it's like, what? Like, how did that happen? The church in Smyrna, all these other letters to the churches, the seven churches, God is actually correcting them. He's offering words of confrontation. Remember last week as we studied the church of Ephesus, he said, "You have lost your first love." But when he gets to Smyrna, there is no correction. There is no confrontation. There's only encouragement. There's only consolation. Now, to give some context, Smyrna was about 35 miles up the coast from Ephesus, which we studied last week. It would have been the next stop on the postal route after Ephesus, which is why it is the second letter here in Revelation. Now, things to know about Smyrna. Smyrna was a large and wealthy port city. It had a thriving economy, which meant that it had some of the wealthiest and most affluent people in the ancient world. And yet, I don't know if you notice, but the people that John is writing to are suffering. There's abundance and wealth all around them, but they're experiencing poverty. Have you ever felt like that? Like, everyone around you is experiencing blessing. They're leveling up. They're progressing, while you're the only one who seems to be struggling. You know, our church history is very colorful. When we were coming out of the pandemic, and some of you remember, we were really struggling. Financially, we were in the red like every month, which meant we were losing money every month. Attendance was lower than ever. But when I was looking at the other churches coming out of the pandemic and talking to their pastors, they were experiencing unprecedented growth. Like multiple churches bought buildings coming out of the pandemic. Other churches were moving to multiple services because they were growing. And I remember this feeling of looking around, seeing everyone else experiencing abundance and growth and blessing and wondering why we were here just barely scraping by. These believers in Smyrna, they were surrounded by wealth and abundance, but they were experiencing poverty. And they were faithful, which makes it even worse. It's like, God, we're here being faithful to you, yet we don't get a piece of the pie. But the thing we have to understand is that the church in Smyrna, they weren't just suffering. They were being actively persecuted. Now, Smyrna was the epicenter of worship for Rome and Caesar. If you're familiar with Roman history at all, you would know that the emperors were practically considered deities. They were gods. And so emperor worship was a huge part, a major part of Roman culture. And so imagine this. You're a follower of Jesus living in first century Smyrna. And once a year, every citizen was required to go to the temple, the Roman temple, and burn incense dedicated to the emperor, or to Caesar. And while you were there burning incense, you would have to repeat these words while presenting your offering, Caesar is Lord. And listen, this wasn't optional. Like, you had to do it. And it was so much a part of the culture that you even got a certificate issued to you to show that you had done this thing, that you had burned incense before the altar of Caesar and said, Caesar is Lord. And if you were found to be without that certificate, then you lacked certain societal privileges, and you were even at risk for imprisonment and execution. And so people, you know, you're probably thinking, like, why didn't they just do it? Why didn't they just burn the incense and say these words, even if they didn't mean it? Because failing to offer worship to the emperor was a capital offense and came with very real consequences. Yet, Scripture tells us, in spite of all of this, how easy it would have been just to do it and then go worship in secret. The followers of Jesus in Smyrna refused to burn incense at the altar of Rome. They refused to say Caesar is Lord, and as a result, they were at odds with the government, they were at odds with the dominant culture, and they were targets of persecution. But second, and more surprisingly, there was a large population of Jews who hated Christians because they thought they were a cult. They would hear stories of them eating the flesh of Christ and drinking his blood. And they'd be like, oh my God, who are these weirdos? They are a cult. Not knowing that they were just actually doing communion, doing it symbolically. And so they looked at Christians and thought they're a cult. And so Gentiles or non-Jewish people were often the target of persecution by the religious Jews. As a result, this put them at great odds with the dominant religious institutions too. All this to say, Smyrna was not a friendly place to live as a follower of Jesus. Think about it. They were at odds with the government. They were at odds with the dominant culture, and they were at odds with the dominant religious institution of the time. And this had a direct correlation with their poverty, because believers were often prohibited from working many of the best jobs that would pay well. They were often prohibited from certain societal privileges because of their allegiance to Jesus. It was a form of economic persecution. Now, this is really hard for us to imagine here in the West. Because, like, what persecution, right? You're probably hearing this and like, this is so far from my experience as a follower of Jesus here in America. We're not being imprisoned for our beliefs. We're not being executed for our religious beliefs. We're not being denied jobs or economic opportunities because of our faith. We're not being targeted by the dominant religious institutions. We are the dominant religious institution of America. And I think it's very interesting that there's a growing number of evangelical Christians in America who complain about being persecuted, because if anything, historically, we have been the instigators of persecution. We have been the most vocal about denying LGBTQ plus people the legal rights to marry. We have denied women authority to hold positions of power and leadership. And although Christians played an important role in abolishing slavery here in America, it was also Christians on the other side who were fighting against abolition to preserve their power and their privilege. I always like to say Christians in the West, we kind of have main character syndrome. Do you guys know what that means? It means we're notorious for seeing ourselves as the main character. We're notorious for reading the Bible and always seeing ourselves as the main characters. We see ourselves as David, but never as Saul. We see ourselves as the Israelites, but never as Babylon. We see ourselves as the oppressed, but never as the oppressors. But the reality is that the American church today looks a lot more like the Roman Empire than it does the persecuted church. Real persecuted looks like Christians in China being imprisoned for having a Bible. Real persecution looks like Christians being murdered in Sudan for believing in Jesus. What do we know of this kind of persecution? So texts like this, they're kind of hard. Because how then do we connect with this letter? If that is so far from our experience, what is Jesus saying to us here in our comfortable, privileged churches in America? I think one question we can consider is this. Is your allegiance truly to Christ, or is your allegiance to the power and the privilege and the blessings that come with it? In other words, would you continue being a follower of Jesus, even if it cost you everything? Your reputation, economic opportunity, your family, your freedom, your life. Some of you are like, of course. Listen, I'm a pastor. I've been a pastor for 10 years, and I struggle answering this question. If you lived in a country experiencing heavy persecution, would you still choose to follow Jesus at risk of losing everything? The church in Smyrna made a decision to follow Jesus at great cost, at great cost to their livelihoods, at great cost to their loved ones, at great cost to their very bodies. And this is what Jesus commends them for. And I think it causes us to take a moment of introspection to ask, could I do the same if everything was on the line? With that said, I think although we don't experience the kind of physical and economic persecution that the church in Smyrna did, there are some ways this plays out culturally. And although Christianity is still very much the dominant religion in America, we are in many ways a post-Christian nation, meaning Christianity's influence on our nation's culture, sense of morality, and worldview have dramatically decreased, not to mention the fact that the societal perception of Christians at large has grown increasingly negative over the past decades. Christians are regularly mocked in the media, seen as behind the times, bigoted or fanatical. Even Jesus, who was pretty much untouchable decades ago, is no longer immune from catching strays in entertainment, right? None of it's sacred anymore. And I want to acknowledge that this is real, right? You likely feel this very strongly here in the Bay Area. You probably feel this in your workplace. You probably feel this in your relationships, in your family. The tension in, do I pray for my meal in front of my coworkers? Do I tell people that I'm a Christian? That I talk to this invisible sky daddy? Do I tell people, what will people think of me if they hear I go to church every Sunday to volunteer for free? And so I want to acknowledge that that tension is real. It's easy to feel this need to hide our faith from the outside world. But Jesus tells us that we will be mocked for our faith, that our faith will look like foolishness to the world. It simply comes with the territory. And all of this begs the question, am I living in such a way that people would even find evidence to persecute me? There's this scenario that a pastor laid out where this man was brought to court, and basically the court was examining his life, looking at his schedule every single day, Monday through Sunday, looking at his finances, looking at his journals, looking at his house, looking at what he owned, looking at his habits. And as they were examining these things, they were trying to decide, is this person a follower of Jesus or not? And the guy was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to be in prison. I'm going to be arrested. Because yes, I'm a follower. But when they combed through this guy's entire life, they found no evidence that they were actually a follower of Jesus. And so they got off free. And you would think this person would be happy, but they actually started mourning inside because they realized, I call myself a follower of Jesus, but nothing in my life looks like I do. All of this begs the question, does my life look different? Or is it indistinguishable from those that I know who don't follow Jesus? If you were to grab a camera and document my life for the next week, would it look different than someone who doesn't claim to be a follower of Jesus? And so if there's anything this letter to the church in Smyrna challenges us to do, is to live a life that's actually characterized by Christ, our habits, our character, our relationships and the way we treat others, our work and how we approach it should be different from the world. So that's the first thing to consider. But the second thing to consider is this. Although we may not know persecution as those in Smyrna did, we do know suffering. We do know pain. We do know loss and heartbreak. We do know disappointment. In this letter to the church in Smyrna, Jesus makes these three statements in response to the suffering that they're experiencing that I think Jesus is speaking to us today. And he sums it up in three statements. I am, I know, and I will give. I am. Jesus says, I am the first and the last who died and came to life again. I think it's interesting that Jesus' first statement to the suffering community is not a resolution to their suffering, is not an encouragement in the midst of their suffering. It's a reminder of who it is that's in their corner, who it is that's on their side, who it is that is holding their very lives. Jesus says, I am the first and the last, Alpha and Omega, beginning and the end, which means everything in between, beginning and end, is under his authority. He was there before the foundations of the earth, and he is there at the end of time, and this is who is for us. Listen, whatever you're experiencing today, you have a powerful friend in your corner. You have the first and the last on your side. You have the one who died and came back to life with you. And I think what some of us need to hear in the midst of our suffering isn't consolation, isn't comfort that we're going to come out of it. It's that he is the Alpha and the Omega. He is the first and the last, and he is with you. But the second thing Jesus says, he says, I know. I know your afflictions and your poverty. That word affliction, what it really means, it's not just a burden. It's not just heaviness. It's literally a burden that crushes. And some of you, you're in here today and you know exactly what that feels like. You're living under a burden that is crushing you. And when Jesus says, I know your afflictions, he's not just communicating that he has information about what's happening in your life. It's not Jesus just saying, listen, I saw your Instagram post the other day. Wow, you're really going through it. I'm sorry about that. He's not just communicating knowledge about our situation. He's saying, I am with you. He's saying, I have been there before. I know what you're going through, and I am with you. There's something so comforting about being in relationship with someone who has been where you are. Listen, no offense, but when I'm experiencing trouble in my marriage, I'm not trying to talk to a newlywed, okay? When I'm not trying to talk to someone who's been married for 2 weeks. I'm trying to talk to someone who has been through it, who has stood the test of time and chose to love each other despite their circumstances. I want to talk to someone who has been where I'm at. And there's something so comforting, so reassuring about talking with someone who's experienced what you have, who has been in your position, who has experienced your struggle. And we have a God who knows what it's like to be where you're at. He says, I know your afflictions, and I am with you. But then Jesus does something interesting. He says something that's quite controversial. He says, I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. Yo, if someone said that to me in the midst of my suffering, I would wholly slap the hell out. Like, why would you say that to someone who is suffering, who is in affliction, who is in poverty, and tell them, no, you're not, you're rich? Like, it seems really insensitive. What Jesus is doing, though, is he's reframing their poverty. Listen, we all know that it's possible to be financially wealthy, but miserable and wretched on the inside. And on the other hand, we know that it's possible to be financially poor, yet still feel fulfilled and whole and happy within. Now, what Jesus isn't saying is that people experiencing poverty should just accept their poverty and not do anything about it. He's not saying we shouldn't do everything in our power to help those in poverty because actually they're rich, right? That would be dumb. He's not saying that the systems that perpetuate poverty should not be addressed. But what Jesus says, when he says, I know your poverty, yet you are rich, he's saying you are rich because although your circumstances are bleak and dire, although your circumstances are afflicting you, your suffering has brought you close to me. In other words, God draws particularly close to those who are suffering. Scripture tells us the Lord is near the brokenhearted. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is reminding us that even in the worst moments of suffering that we can experience, we are rich. And listen, I can testify this to be true because some of my most profound encounters with God happen in the thick of my deepest suffering. Have you been there before? Where you've been at your lowest, but it opened this opportunity for you to experience the nearness of God in ways that you have never experienced before. Hear me, church. Sometimes God allows you to go through a situation because he's about to give you a revelation. And sometimes you can't get a revelation unless you go through that situation. Sometimes it takes a situation of lack to get a revelation of God as provider. Sometimes it takes a situation of sickness to get a revelation that he is healer. Sometimes it takes a situation of anxiety to get a revelation of God as the Prince of Peace. And some of you are wondering, why am I going through what I'm going through right now, God? Why am I experiencing this pain and this heartache and this suffering and this affliction? Is it possible, maybe, that God is allowing you to experience a situation because he's about to give you a revelation that's going to blow your mind? Maybe you're about to experience God's presence, God's breakthrough in a new way. There was a time in college where I was extremely depressed. I was probably at one of my lowest, and it obviously happened because I experienced heartbreak and I broke up with my girlfriend. And I was at this really low place, but I remember distinctly in that season, it was in that low valley, in that deep darkness, in that deep depression, where I experienced the presence, the tangible presence of God in a way that I'd never experienced before. Could it be that your situation, your suffering, your affliction right now is an opportunity for God to reveal himself in a brand new way? I am, I know. And then Jesus says, I will give. He says, do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Jesus says, there's more suffering, there's more persecution, there's more imprisonment on the way. And when I first read this, I was like, man, what a thing to say to people who are already suffering. When I used to do Taekwondo, Zion started Hapkido, by the way, this last week. My oldest son, he started a Korean martial arts known as Hapkido. And it brought back a lot of memories when I was a kid doing Taekwondo, which is also Korean martial art. And I remember that our master was very cruel. Like, Zion's master is so nice. We call him master, the teacher. But Zion's master was so sweet. He was so nice. He was so accommodating. But I remember our master, like, used to literally beat us. Like, he would grab a wooden stick, and one time he got so mad, he broke it right above my head onto the punching bag, and like shards flew everywhere. Like, that was, I mean, the 90s were wild, right? And I remember experiencing things like that, but I remember distinctly there would be these moments where we're so tired after doing drills for like 30 minutes, and then right there in our lowest tired moments, he'd be like, all right, now the real work begins. And I remember feeling so demoralized, so discouraged, and I'm reading this, I'm like, Jesus, these people are suffering, they're afflicted, they're in poverty, and yet you tell them, hey, guess what? More suffering's on the way, more persecution. Like, what a thing to say. But then he says, do not be afraid. And he gives this oddly specific number. He says, you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Now, when you read this, we read 10 days and we're like, oh, good. Like, they only have to suffer 10 more days. Hooray. They actually suffered way more than 10 days, just to give you a cue. When he says 10 days here, he doesn't literally mean 10 days. A lot of scholars read this and say, Jesus is not literally referencing 10 days. I wish Jesus would give us like the specificity of how long we'll suffer. Like, listen, you're going to get fired, get ready, and you're going to experience unemployment for 42.5 days, and then you're going to find a brand new job. Like, I wish Jesus worked like that. I wish he says you're going to experience suffering and depression for 4 months, and then bam, it's over, right? And we're like, God, how long is this pain going to last? And he responds, 525,600. Like, I wish he just told us, like, a year, I could do a year, right? I could do 5 months. I could do 2 years, as long as I know how long it'll be. What makes suffering unbearable at times is that we don't know when it will end. And that tortures us. We don't know how long it will last. We don't know the details. And we wish we did. We wish Jesus would tell us the length of our pain. But when Jesus says 10 days, although he's not telling us the length of that time that that suffering will last, when Jesus says 10 days, he's assuring us of this, that suffering has an expiration date. And you can trust in the words of the first and the last, the beginning and the end, because he who has seen you at the beginning of your suffering has also seen the end of your suffering. He who saw you cry your first tear has also seen you cry your last tear. And scripture tells us that sorrow, though it may last for the night, joy comes in the morning. That even though you'll experience suffering, suffering has an expiration date. If I could be just transparent about where I'm at this season, I'm actually like really depressed right now. I'm experiencing like a bout of depression. It's lasted for a few years, honestly. And it's interesting because I've never been at such a low place while so many beautiful things are happening in my life at the same time. Like my kids are born and they're wonderful and they're growing up and they're such amazing people. But I just came to this realization, shoot, I'm like depressed. And so I've taken some steps. I'm like seeing a therapist. I'm surrounding myself with relationships and friends. But the other day, I wrote in my journal, and it became so clear to me that I'm still in the thick of it right now, but I remember writing this down. I said, these days will one day be a story of God's goodness. Like, I'm living through a testimony right now, and it sucks right now. But also, I had this clarity to realize that these days will one day be my story of God's goodness. And I think, for those of us who are in the midst of suffering and pain, maybe you're experiencing depression, maybe you're experiencing a lot of anxiety, or you're in circumstances that are just sucky, I think the one thing that Jesus calls us to cling to is that your suffering has an expiration date. And Jesus says, don't be afraid. I think it's interesting the phrase, do not be afraid, a lot of scholars say actually pops up in the Bible 365 times. Which is meant to signify one for every day of your life. Jesus wants us to know every day of our lives, do not be afraid, for I am with you. And he tells them, do not be afraid, because I will give you life as your victor's crown. All of this, even though it seems like it's pointing towards death, even though it seems like it's pointing towards hell and darkness, all of this is actually pointing you towards life. And that's a hard thing for us to grasp, that in the midst of our suffering and our pain, that all of it is actually pointing us towards life that Jesus is going to give us, and that all of it will be worth it. Today, I know that these words to the church in Smyrna, there was no correction, there was no confrontation, but I feel like Jesus is confronting some of us today. And I think the thing he's confronting us with is, number one, are you living a life that would get you persecuted? Does your life look any different from those who don't follow Jesus? And if not, maybe it's a challenge to start really living an authentic life of faith. But second, I think there are words of comfort for those of us who are experiencing suffering. And Jesus is reminding us of who he is in our lives, that he knows our affliction, that he is with us, and that he will give us life. There is an expiration date to what you're going through. So right now, why don't we close our eyes as we get ready to respond? God, I thank you that you are with us. Although we might not know exactly the kind of persecution that this church in Smyrna experienced, we do know suffering. We do know pain. We do know heartbreak. And today, I just feel like you want us to know that you are with us. That the one who has seen the beginning and seen the end is with us. That you know what we're experiencing because you've experienced it too. And you have reached the end. You have come back from death to life. And that is the trajectory of our suffering. That is the trajectory of everything we're experiencing. It is from death to life. And even when it feels like it's life to death, would you remind us that we follow the one who has reversed the curse, who has gone from death to life? Would you comfort us knowing that our suffering has an end date and that you will crown us with life? And so help us, God. Help us not be afraid. Help us not be discouraged. Help us trust in the good shepherd who will lead us to life.